All right, so welcome everyone coming together today. I'm Pandey Sujato. We're going to do some meditation, some chanting, some Dhamma talk. Does that sound okay? Is that all right? Very good. Begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of this land, the Bharamadagu people of the Darug Nation. And I feel I have to just briefly mention the referendum that was held last weekend for the Voice, and as of course you all know, the Voice referendum failed, which was very gravely disappointing to myself and to very many of us. I'm not going to try to do too much of a post-mortem here, but I just wanted to express my gratitude for some people for this process. First of all, to Australia's Indigenous people, for calling us to be better and for believing in us to support them and to help to build a better nation. And we see around the world in so many places that when people are dispossessed, oppressed and disadvantaged, that they turn to violence and they turn to all kinds of things. And instead, our Indigenous people had faith in our humanity and called us out to be better. And since I heard about The Voice, I have only encountered people of nobility and compassion and wisdom, and I felt that it was something that to me was an opportunity to understand my own Australianness and my own humanity better. And so I'm really grateful to all of those Indigenous people who initiated this movement and who sustained us through the process. Also like to express my gratitude, especially to Shireen from the Radical Reform Centre, Macquarie Uni, who's the one who got me involved with that. Also to the Australian Buddhist communities, the Buddhist councils and the Australian Sangha Association, who gave their support to The Voice. And a lot of gratitude for engaging with that process and for everybody doing what they could. Also, I'd like to express a word of gratitude for our government, especially the Australian Labor Party, who actually held the referendum. Not an easy thing to do. It's expensive, it's time-consuming, it's difficult. And, you know, at the end of the day, what the request was from the Uluru Statement was from the heart, was to hold a referendum so the Australian people could decide this. And that's really all the government can do, is hold a referendum. And they did that, and the Australian people decided. Obviously, I disagree with that decision, but that's how it goes. Also, special shout out to the Australian Electoral Commission for running a good election. If those of us who've been in Australia for a long time can get kind of used to that and take it for granted. But as we've seen in many of our friends, especially in the United States and other places, when you let your electoral process decay, then it is very troubling and very worrying. And for those who are wondering, yes, I did actually cast a yes vote in this referendum. It's the first time I've voted in anything since I can't remember. Normally monks and nuns don't vote in elections because it's a political thing, it's about power. But this to me wasn't about power, it was about human decency and human rights. So I was very proud to stroll gently on down to the Rosella High School, stand in line for a couple of minutes, and then have an actual human being with a piece of paper that you could write on. It was great. There was like no computers there. It was fantastic. But just, you know, nice people helping to facilitate the democracy. And to me, that is a really nice, you know, it's just worth bearing in mind, because it's not something that we can take for granted. So obviously, those things aside, it is a very, quite a depressing outcome for many of us, and we don't really know what's going to come next, but all I can say is that for my part, that the next time that our Indigenous people call us to help and to support, then I'll do my best to be there for them again. All right, let us recite words of homage for the Tripitaka. Thank you.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagavāra sammasambuddho vijjacarana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarati sattha deva manusana buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandirthiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatang veditabbo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Samichipatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Yadidam chattari purisa yugani artha purisa pungala. Esa bhagavato savakasangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhirneyo anjali karaniyo anutaram punyaketa lokasati.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. Okay, so for today's meditation, we're going to do a meditation on craving. And As most of you are meditators and practitioners, I'm sure you already have some familiarity with the idea of craving, the idea of desire. Now, on one sense, from one dimension, the whole idea of craving and desire is very obvious. Everybody knows that human beings have desires, that we want things. Our whole economic system is built on the idea of demand. And so I'm just waiting for a couple of people to come in. Please come in. Just in time. Could we maybe open a window as well? Stuffing.
I have a window.
Sorry, everyone. Just dealing with the high-tech contrivances here. Yes, we can get a window open. Excellent. It's a nice night though, isn't it? Is that going to work? No. No. Not going to work? Okay. Never mind, well, the one is good enough. So as I was saying, we have desire for things, and then when we can't do what we want, then we get frustrated and it becomes suffering. Sometimes it's a desire to get reborn. Sometimes it's simply the desire to open a window. And in between those two desires is this little thing called the rest of human existence. I like to call life itself. And we are, so even though craving and desire is, very widely noted and so on, the Buddha gave it a very central role in his teaching. And the whole idea of craving, tanha, or thirst, is not just something that human beings have, not just something that we do from time to time or we experience from time to time, but it's the very roots of our human existence. And existence in all the realms driven by this craving, this tanha, this thirst. Remember when we were on a Buddhist pilgrimage? Buddhist pilgrimages in India are funny because there's this kind of alternation between going to these very sacred sites and then having these very peaceful and holy experiences and then going shopping. And then people staying in these big hotels. And we finally arrived in Delhi and we're at this big hotel and the bar was called Trishna. And I was like, yeah, that's it. That sounds about right. So so it looks like there's some network problems with the video, but I think that's not sure we can do anything about that. Come, welcome. Alrighty. So desire is something that we experience in our meditation, but the interesting thing is, one interesting thing about desire is that it likes to hide itself. And it likes to sort of keep itself, it's this very kind of small thing It's very innocuous. And it expresses itself in the mind in just this very kind of subtle movement. And in our meditation, we can learn through developing the clarity and mindfulness to actually see the inception of desire as it creates like a wind stirring in a peaceful day, or a ripple coming onto the surface of a pond. And we can see this movement of the mind that's been created by desire. And so one of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism is that when you can let go of these desires, then your mind will be peaceful. And of course, this is an experiential reality. Once we can learn to identify these things, we can find our mind is peaceful. Of course, what tends to happen is that when people come to meditation, they kind of add one more desire to their list of desires. So now I desire to become peaceful, and so they have this kind of incompatibility, right? So on the one hand, you want to enjoy all the good things that life has to offer, and you want to have peace of mind, and so on, right? And that capacity to double think and to imagine that you can have and fulfill all desires while at the same time getting enlightened. This is a little thing I like to call American Buddhism. Moving on, though. Moving on, though. So apologies to any American. I'm just joking. But look, in one way, to hold those two incompatible things, you know, that's how it is. That's how samsara is. You know, we are in this world where on the one hand we are pulled towards peace and wisdom, and on the other hand we are pulled towards distraction and ignorance. And we somehow have to make our way in the middle of this. And this is why life appears to be struggling and so on. So one useful thing that we can do here is to clarify the goal and the intent of the meditation itself. Maybe we're not ready to think, oh, I'm going to give up all desires, I'm going to renounce everything. It's all right. No, Buddha's not insisting that everyone give up everything right away, okay? But in this period of meditation, let's be clear in our minds that we are going to desire nothing. We're going to desire no sight, sound, smell, taste, or touch. We're not going to desire anything in the future. We're not going to have any kind of longing for the past. We're not going to desire to be anything or anyone right here and now. That's our aim, at least for that meditation. Yeah, and so we can regard this as a psychological experiment. Each time we come to meditate, what would it be like if I had no desires? And so even if you tell yourself, oh, I can't let go of desires, I can't let go of my attachments, oh, I'm too attached to this, I'm too attached to that, that's okay. Maybe you can't. But what if you were to pretend to be somebody who could let go of attachments? So maybe you can't be an arahant, you can't be a Buddha, whatever, but maybe you can just say, okay, I'm going to do a pretend meditation as if I was an enlightened being. What would that be like? And so, see, the reason for throwing out this idea is because a lot of the times we limit our possibilities by the stories that we tell ourselves. And that's just another kind of sense of self. If you tell yourself, I can't do it, that's just I-making, that's just ahankara. You're defining your sense of self and limiting yourself according to what your past and your conditioning and your perceptions tell you. What if you were to be free from that? What if it was really the case that it's possible to let go of desires and actually be free? So in our meditation, we can at least try that out. Maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. Usually we'll find that it works to a certain degree. and that we can see that even to be able to let go of these desires and identify them for this, to this degree and for this period of time, already leads to that peace of mind. And so this is where we are starting to get the wisdom of experience. Yeah? And even that much is very powerful. Maybe we're not ready to say, oh, I'm going to renounce everything and so on, but maybe at least to know that you're not completely trapped by your desires. That's pretty good, actually. That's pretty powerful. Yeah. There's a nice passage, I don't know if you've read the book Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, which is like probably the least reliable book on the life of the Buddha ever written. And there are a lot. This is like stiff competition in that field. But one of the things that that I remember, one of the passages, was he said, you know, what is your skill set? He was asked at one time. He says, well, I can fast. I can go without food. He said, well, what use is that? He said, it's incredibly useful because it means if you don't get anything to eat, then you don't worry about it. Yeah, that, and that is that skill set of being able to let go. Imagine that. Imagine thinking that way about everything that you encounter. Oh, I'm stuck in a queue. Oh, I don't have to worry because I don't really care. Now is now. The present is the present. Being in the front of the queue or the back of the queue doesn't really matter. That's all right. Maybe you don't get that promotion at your job. Oh, well, that's okay. You did your best. All you can worry about is what you're doing. And so we can have some perspective on our desires without letting them rule us quite so unreflectively. All right, let us do some meditation. Sitting quietly, let the mind settle back into your body. That sense of ease and pleasure, comfort. Each time you meditate, use this perception to create this idea that the meditation is just such a lovely, comfortable, peaceful place. You can let go of all the past. You can let go of all the future. Nothing you want, nothing you need. So beautiful, so easeful. Imagine mind becomes so peaceful, not wanting anything, not wanting to be anywhere, just mindful and grounded and still. Look deep in your heart. And stay alert for that craving as it appears. Don't be distracted by your senses, by your thoughts, by your ideas, memories. Look underneath those things. It's that movement of the mind that reaches out, that force, that energy. Wants, thirsts. This desire is very sneaky. When we shine the light of awareness on it, it hides. And when our mindfulness wavers and our attention drifts, leaps out, looking for this or that. But if you're very still, very alert, you can feel it like the ripples on a still pond as a fish rises to the surface. Notice how when your mind slips in its mindfulness, lets the desire go out, lets the thirst go out, that you become agitated, distressed, tense. And when you recognize that desire for what it is, and decide, no, I'm not going to follow it, and soon the mind will settle down and it will find its peace. and learn to relish that mind of peace, that mind free of desire. Pay attention. Appreciate it. Isn't it amazing that you can feel perfectly content and happy without anything? Just to sit. Be at peace. Okay, so now we're coming near to the end of the meditation. Bring your mind back into the senses, back into the world around you. And just take a minute to reflect back, asking yourself, what just happened? How did my mind change? What was it like in those different parts of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings find peace and fulfillment. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. All right, very good. So let's have a short break and come back for the Dhamma talk. Welcome back everybody, and welcome to all of our folks online. And for the folks online, if you are able to turn your cameras on, that's good, then I can see you. Good, human beings, nice. very good. Okay, so today we're continuing with the series that we're doing over this Rains Retreat looking at some suttas, and especially looking at suttas that I've been working on during the week and doing some annotation with and so on. This one's a little bit simpler and lighter than some of the other ones that we've done, but still interesting. Sorry, I just accidentally closed it. Right. And this is Madhyama Nikaya number 37, the shorter discourse on the ending of craving, hence our meditation that we just did. So let us proceed. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Savatthi in the Eastern Monastery in the stilt longhouse of Migara's mother. And just brief note on that, this was of course the second most well-known monastery in Savatthi after the Jetavana, and it was offered by the laywoman Visakha, who was known conventionally as Migara's mother. And as it says there, it was a stilt longhouse, a posada. And so in those days, they didn't use much brick construction. So the stilt longhouse was kind of the biggest thing. Like royal palaces were built that way. You still find that in Thailand today, like some of the royal palaces in Bangkok are like teak longhouses built out of, on stilts. So apparently quite a magnificent building. Then Sakka, the Lord of Gods, went up to the Buddha, bowed, stood to one side, and said to him, "Sir, how do you briefly define a mendicant who is freed through the ending of craving, who has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate sanctuary from the yoke, the ultimate spiritual life, and the ultimate goal, and is best among gods and humans?" To which the Buddha replied, sorry, I'm just finding a quick reference while I'm doing this. To which the Buddha replied, "Lord of Gods, it's when a mendicant has heard, nothing is worth insisting on. Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesanaya. When a mendicant has heard that nothing is worth insisting on, they directly know all things. Directly knowing all things, they completely understand all things. Having completely understood all things, when they experience any kind of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, they meditate observing impermanence, dispassion, cessation, and letting go in those feelings. Meditating in this way, they don't grasp at anything in the world. Not grasping, they're not anxious. Not being anxious, they personally become extinguished. They understand rebirth is ended. The spiritual journey has been completed. What had to be done has been done, and there is no return to any state of existence. That's how I briefly define a mendicant who is freed through the ending of craving, who has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate sanctuary from the yoke, the ultimate spiritual life, the ultimate goal, and is best among gods and humans." And then Sakka, Lord of Gods, having approved and agreed with what the Buddha said, bowed and respectfully circled the Buddha, keeping him on his right before vanishing right there. All right, so I'm going to break it off there. We're going to have a bit of a look into this teaching. First thing is, who are these characters here? Well, there's the Buddha, who we know. Who is the Buddha, by the way? The awakened one?
Yeah.
Gautama Buddha? Yeah. He's like this kind of mythical figure, right? Is that right?
No.
Is that right? No? Is he like that really kind of fat guy with lots of babies on him?
No.
Is that the Buddha? Is that Buddha? No? That's what they sometimes say. Is that right? No? He was a human being. Yeah, he became enlightened. Okay, fine. I'm only teasing you now. Okay, fine. Then Sakka, the Lord of Gods. Now, who knows who Sakka is? Anybody know Sakka personally? Anyone met him? No? Not recently. anybody know about him? Anyone got any goss, any of the hot tea on who Sakka is? Folks online, please, most welcome to chime in. But no ChatGPT, okay? anyone? This should have been on the Buddhist trivia quiz, right? Okay, the highest deva, really the highest one? I mean, there's a lot, right? There's Brahma Sahampati and so on. But he's called Sakka, Lord of Gods, right? So he's obviously somebody, you know. But they do like their titles, these gods. They quite like them. So Sakka is, in Buddhism, regarded as the head of the 33 gods. So Buddhist cosmology, I won't go into it, but there's all these different kind of levels and so on of gods, heaven realms and so on. And the one that we probably hear about the most is around what we call the 33. And the top dog, or should that be top god? The top god there is Sakka, okay? And Sakka appears many times in the suttas. And he is the inheritor of which Vedic deity? Yes.
Indra.
Indra, of course, yes. So he's called Devanam Indra, the Indra of the gods, literally. So Indra by this time means the sense of ruler or leader. So Saka is Indra. Now, that means that he has a character arc, okay? He develops over time. In the Vedas, he was a very rowdy war god who is celebrated for, among other things, slaying the dragon. That he was like the original dragon slayer, and what you find in the Rig Veda. So the Rig Veda, you're talking like 1,000 years before the Buddha, and even in the Rig Veda, the myths about Indra are already old. In their time, they're already old, and they just allude to them in passing. You know, just like Indra slew the dragon, so too something something something. So it was already, they just assumed that these stories were part of what everybody knew. So this is going back a long, long time. So Indra was, you know, ferocious and a bit of a kind of war god and all of these kinds of things. He liked a tipple. Yes, specifically of Soma. Yeah? And so he liked to take the Soma. What is Soma? Some kind of drug. Right? Some kind of drug. So Soma was like some kind of, it was a divinity, it was a god, and it was some kind of chemical agent, okay? A liquid that would be pressed out at the rituals and would be drunk, and that would give you certain powers and abilities. Many candidates for Soma have been proposed, mushrooms being one popular one, but I think most likely Soma was ephedra originally. So ephedra being a natural plant, which is essentially natural speed, a stimulant. So there's kind of two camps, one who see Soma as being a hallucinogen and one who see it as being a stimulant. And I think it's more likely a stimulant. And I think that the cultural significance of it was that you took a bunch of speed, got on your horses and went roaring in, raping and raiding and killing and marauding and destroying. And that's who Indra was. So through taking the Soma, Indra was manifesting his Indraness, his Indriya, as you might say. So we have this idea of Indriya in Buddhism as being like a spiritual potential. Right? So Indra revealed his true nature, his true power, when he took the Soma, and he could then go and smash and smite and kill. Fortunately, he had already encountered the Buddha before this point, and so he had given up those very violent ways that he had in the past. He'd now become an acolyte of peace. So this is nice. The Buddha and Sakka met first in a long discourse in the Digha Nikaya number 21, called the Sakkapanha Sutta, which is a great text, and you should read it. I'm just going to pop the link for that in there as well. And in there, interestingly enough, that begins with Sakka saying, oh, I can't really go up and see the Buddha, and like, how could someone like me go and see the Buddha, right? He's kind of got a bit of a guilty conscience. Yeah, he's done a lot of not very nice things, you know, starting with slaying dragons. And so as a kind of god of who's associated with violence and war and destruction, then he's reluctant to see the Buddha, but he does go. The Buddha teaches him, he becomes converted and becomes a stream enterer. Notice how in this sutta, he's not trepidatious at all. He just goes up to the Buddha and says, hey Buddha, how do you do this? Right? It's not even, you know, just very straightforward narrative, right? So this is following that conversion. And in fact, this question actually links up directly with the question in the previous sutta. So the last question that he asks in Digha Nikaya number 21 is, let me see, so I just have to look for this. The last question that he asks is, Ah, right. Dear sir, do all ascetics and Brahmins, so this is Sakka asking the Buddha, do all ascetics and Brahmins, have all ascetics and Brahmins reached the ultimate end, the ultimate sanctuary from the yoke, the ultimate spiritual life, the ultimate goal? And of course, this is the same terms, exactly the same wording that he's using in Madhyama 27. And the Buddha says, no, not all have. And the Buddha says, well, those who are freed from craving have reached that ultimate goal, and those who are not freed from craving have not reached that ultimate goal. And that's where that series of questions ends at that point. So this is a later time. Sakka's obviously been ruminating and reflecting on this. Now he wants to go deeper and says, well, what does it mean when you say those who've let go of the ending of craving, who are those people? And so he's really picking up those questions that he had before, which is kind of interesting. I mean, it shows that he was paying attention, reflecting, and that he's deepening his practice. Now, the Diga Nikaya number 21 says that he became a stream enterer at the end of that. And so here he's asking about the arahant, all right? So he's asking about that further practice, all right? So for those of you concerned about such things, like in case you're wondering, like, did this really happen? Is there really a Sakka? Did he really go to the Buddha and ask these things? I would have to say I wasn't there. And as far as I know, there's no footage, so I cannot say. So I can just treat this as a text and it's a story, and I can tell you what the story is all about. But, I mean, obviously, you know, for me, the psychological and physical and philosophical realities are true, but whether it's true that there was this actual event with Sakka coming to see the Buddha, I am not an expert in such matters, so I cannot comment. Sorry? There are Chinese parallels to both of these suttas, yeah. Let me see. Thank you for that question. Let me just check. There's a handy little widget we can use here called Sutta Central. And Sutta Central tells us that for the current sutta, the Chulasthana Sankhya Sutta, there are two Chinese parallels, one in the Ekottarika Agama and one in the Samyukta Agama. And then there are some other parallels to different parts of it, but they're the two main parallels that we have listed here. Okay, and if anybody wants to look at those, remember that Venerable Anālio has completed a full study of all the suttas in the Madhyama Nikaya and the parallels. So if you want to check the parallels for these things, always a good thing to do, especially if you want to study them in some detail. Okay. So Sakka's continuing on from those questions and asking about it. Now then the Buddha responds in quite an interesting way, because he's asked about, you know, about a mendicant free from craving. Okay, fine. This is quite a common topic, right, in the suttas. The Buddha's, you know, constantly talking about this. And he responds in a very particular way. It's when a mendicant has heard that nothing is worth insisting on. Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesanaya. It's an interesting phrase, like, it's a very kind of powerful phrase. More literally, you could translate it as sabbe dhamma, all things, nalang, are not worth abhinivesanaya, are not worth insisting on. All things are not worth insisting on. All things are not worth actually insisting on is really the best translation of that. Now, not only does Sakka calling back to the previous discourse, but now the Buddha is as well. Because the previous question that they had discussed with Sakka was precisely about this point. And I'm just going to briefly go here. The previous section, before the Buddha, before Sakka asked about the freedom from the ending of craving and reaching the ultimate end, he asked the following question. Do all ascetics and Brahmins have a single doctrine, ethics, desire, and attachment? No, Lord of Gods, they do not. Why not? Because the world has many and diverse elements. Whatever elements sentient beings insist on in this world of many and diverse elements, they obstinately stick to it, insisting that this is the only truth. Other ideas are silly. That's why not all ascetics and Brahmins have a single doctrine as ethics, desire, and attachment. And so the Buddha is actually calling back to that previous conversation as well. and pointing to the importance of this idea of abhinivesana, right, of insistence. And you can get a good idea of what that is from that previous discourse. So insistence is like one of the strongest and most reified forms of craving. It's not just liking something, not even just wanting something, not even just grasping something, not even just getting attached to something, but it's insisting on it. Must be like this, and it cannot be any other way, right? And that phrasing there, moghamanyang, right? You know how that gets in your own mind when you get so attached to an idea that you don't just think that you're right, but you think that anybody who thinks differently must be an idiot, right? There can be no possible other explanation, right? That's this one, okay? So whenever you find yourself thinking that if anybody disagrees, thinks something else, they must be an idiot, right? This is this one. This is this insistence. When we hear that, nothing, sabedhama narang abhinivesanaya, nothing is worth insisting on. When you hear that, you directly know all things. Directly knowing all things, you completely understand all things. So this is going briefly through the path of practice in Buddhism. First thing is you hear it. Okay? That's what you're doing here. Right? You're hearing the idea that nothing is worth insisting on. Right? Then we apply that in our experience. Yeah? Then we can apply that in our meditation and experience, and we can directly know all things, right? Sabbe dhamma. How do we directly know all things? Because everything that we see in our meditation has that same quality. Right? When we get attached, what is there that's worth getting attached to? Some feeling comes up. Oh, yeah, this idea comes up. A memory comes up. A thought comes up. Anything that we're experiencing, anything in that world of experience, is that really worth insisting on? All of those things are impermanent and they're conditioned. They're marked by suffering and they are not who we really are. And so this is how we develop that understanding into all things. All things are, the nature of all things is inferred once we know that nothing is worth insisting on. So this is the person who up to this point in this particular sutta is a stream enterer. And when they've completely understood all things, when they experience any kind of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, they meditate observing impermanence, dispassion, cessation, and letting go in these feelings. Okay? So this is the practice of somebody who's already realized the Dhamma. They're now deepening it through continuing to practice. And this, of course, is like directly intended as meditation instructions for Sakha himself, who's a stream enterer. Meditating in this way, they don't grasp at anything in the world. And when the suttas use this phrase, they're always talking about the arahant, the fully enlightened one. Not grasping, right? So this word grasping, upadana, doesn't quite mean attachment and doesn't quite mean clinging, which are two common translations of it. Attachment and clinging are not incorrect translations. But upadana has more of an active sense of grabbing hold of things. Yeah? Upadana is grasping, so upadana is what grasp onto new life. Yes, it means not letting go, but like clinging specifically means refusing to let go. Upadana also means getting something new, grabbing something new, especially getting reborn. So not grasping, they're not anxious, not paritasati. So paritasana is another interesting word. It's from the same root as the word tanha for thirst. And it's one of those words in Pali that has dual roots in Sanskrit or corresponds with two different roots in Sanskrit, and one of them meaning to thirst or desire, and the other one meaning to fear. Right? Yeah, both to desire and to fear. Yeah? So that's why I translate it as anxiety. Yeah? You want something and you're kind of afraid of it at the same time, and yeah, that duality, this is the paritasati. So not grasping, you're not anxious, right? You're not afraid. Am I going to lose this? What am I? Where was I? What am I going to get? How am I going to be able to experience this thing? Or, yeah, all of these fears and anxieties are wrapped up in our desires. And all of that is encoded in just that one word, paritasati. not being anxious, they personally become extinguished, that they become realize nibbana, and they understand that rebirth has ended. So this is the ultimate end, the ultimate sanctuary from the yoke. I'll just briefly explain the term sanctuary from the yoke, another very interesting term. I think I've explained it a number of times before, but never mind. So this is the yoga kema, and this is an image which calls back to the pastoral culture, even preceding the Buddha, where the nomads would have their herds of cattle and horses and goats and so on, and they would wander across the grasslands from one place to another. And maybe like a caravan of oxen or something like that. And then, and it's not easy. It's not easy being on the move all day. It's not easy having to move your cows from to a fresh pasture every day. It's not easy to look out for roving bandits and to get your stray animals and to imagine trying to get the kids to come along and all of that kind of stuff. None of that is easy. And so at the end of the day, you spy a green covered place and you go towards it, and it's a watering hole, an oasis. And that oasis is surrounded by luscious green grass and tall trees. And you go there and you can unyoke your beasts of burden. Yeah, take the yokes off and rest. Yeah, bathe, start a nice fire, have something to eat. Enjoy a night of peace and quiet. So this is the yoga kema, the sanctuary from the yoke. This is where that image comes from. All right. Now, Sakka has got there, asked his question, fine, he's out. All right? Just disappears. Great. It's great being Sakka. You don't have to worry about parking. It's just like, pop in, ask your question, a bit like on Star Trek or something like that. So, fine. Now, at that time, Venerable Mahamoggallana was sitting not far from the Buddha. Sorry, who's this? Remind me, who's Mahamoggallana? One of the Buddha's students? Foremost in psychic powers.
Friends of Sariputta,
yeah? Mahamoggallana, foremost in psychic powers and friends with Sariputta. One of his lesser known achievements was when he was put in charge of the building projects in the monastery. And the buildings all got finished really quickly. Okay, look, you can laugh, okay? But have you, when I went to Ritigala in Sri Lanka, like you go up these hills, okay, and there's jungles and there's elephants and stuff all around, and then you get up, and then like right up on the hill there's these like long stone slabs. They're like, how long? 6 meters long or something like that? Longer? Huge. And you're like, how could you possibly get those stone slabs up there? Well, I know one way you could get them up there. Anyway, moving along. Okay. Where were we? Oh, Mahamoggallana was sitting not far from the Buddha. He thought to himself, did that spirit, that yaka, Sakka, did he comprehend what the Buddha said when he agreed with him or not? Why don't I find out? And then as easily as a strong person would extend or contract their arm, he vanished from the Eastern monastery and reappeared among the gods of the 33. Now, at that time, Sakka was amusing himself in the single lotus park supplied and provided with a divine orchestra. Sounds nice. Seeing Mahamoggallana coming off in the distance, he dismissed the orchestra, approached Mahamoggallana and said, come, my good Moggallana, welcome, sir. It's been a long time since you took the opportunity to come here. Sit, my good Moggallana, this seat is for you. Moggallana sat down on the seat spread out, while Sakka took a low seat and sat to one side. Mahamoggallana said to him, Kosiya, how did the Buddha briefly explain freedom through the ending of craving? Please share this talk with me so that I can also get to hear it. So just a quick note here that Mahamoggallana is addressing Sakka as Kosiya, where the Buddha addressed him as Devanaminda, the Lord of Gods. Kosiya is one of the many, many names of Sakka. There's a list in the sutta somewhere of his names. old gods tend to accumulate a lot of names. Yeah? Now, the Pali tradition explains Kosia as meaning owl. Owl, yeah. Which is what Kosia means in Pali. If that were the case, it would probably be like a totem of a clan name, but unlikely. In the Rig Veda, he's called Kaushika, which is a patronymic. And I think it ultimately goes back to, you see a lot of words in Brahmanic culture that have that kus element. You think of like Kosala, and there's a whole kind of bunch of them. And I think that they all come back to the idea of kusa grass. Kusa grass was a fundamental element in Brahmanical ritual, and particularly in performing the rites of kingship. So to say, call him Kosia essentially meant that he was Brahmanized, so that he was a god. He was probably a pre-Brahman god at some point, long past, but he'd been initiated in the Brahmanical culture, and I think that's what Kosia ultimately means. Anyway, so Mahamoggallana says to him, Kosia, how did the Buddha briefly explain freedom through the ending of craving? Please share this talk with me so that I can also get to hear it. I mean, he was there at the time, but whatever. So my good Moggallana, I have many duties and much to do, not only for myself, but also for the gods of the 33. Besides, what has been well learned, heard and planned and attended to and memorized is not quickly forgotten. Once upon a time, a battle was fought between the gods and the titans. In that battle, the gods won and the titans lost. When I returned from that battle as a conqueror, I created the Palace of Victory. The Palace of Victory has 100 towers. Each tower has 700 chambers. Each chamber has 7 nymphs. Each nymph has 7 maids. Would you like to see the lovely Palace of Victory? So, Saka, not entirely kind of being straight there. We noticed just one quick note on the second sentence there. My earlier translation, which is still on sort of central, is I quickly forget even things I've properly heard, learned, applied the mind and memorized. In fact, I think that's incorrect. It should be things that have been properly heard, learned, applied the mind and memorized are not quickly forgotten, should be the correct translation. But yeah, different translators translate that line differently. So basically he's saying, oh, well, you know, of course I wouldn't forget that. And then what does he immediately do? He starts talking about the glory days, right? Ah, yes, this battle I won, and then I was the conqueror, and all these things, and then I built... Yeah, okay, very impressive. We know that you're the Lord of Gods, all right? So, you know, that's fine. But anyway, so Mahamoggallana consented with silence. Then putting Venerable Mahamoggallana in front, Saka, Lord of Gods, and Vesavana, the great king. So Vesavana, of course, one of the other commonly mentioned deities. He's one of the 4 great kings and also known as Kuveru. They went to the Palace of Victory. When Saka's maids saw Moggallana coming off in the distance, the maids being prudent and discreet, each went to her own bedroom. They were just like a daughter-in-law who's prudent and discreet when they see their father-in-law. So this is one of the passages that I think has been most mistranslated in previous translations of the suttas. The word that describes Saka's maids here is that they possessed Hiri and Otapa. Hiri and Otapa being the guardians of the world, the essence of moral integrity, a sense of conscience. And previous translators had translated it as Saka's maids being embarrassed and ashamed, like they're kind of these giggling girls who have to run away when they see the monk coming. But that's not what they say. It says that they were prudent and discreet. All right? Okay, moving along. So they encouraged Moggallana to wander around and saying, see, in the palace, my good Moggallana, this lovely thing, that lovely thing. Well, that looks nice, you know, just like it would be for someone who's made merit in the past. And humans, when they see something nice, they say, oh, it looks nice enough for the gods of the 33. And it's nice for you that you have all of these things. Then Moggallana thought, this spirit lives much too negligently. Why don't I stir up a sense of urgency in him? So then Moggallana used his psychic power to make the Palace of Victory shake and rock and tremble with his big toe. Then Saka, Vesavana, and the gods of the 33, their minds full of wonder and amazement, thought, oh, how incredible, how amazing. The ascetic has such power and might that he makes the gods' home shake and rock and tremble with his big toe. Knowing that Saka was shocked and awestruck, Moggallana said to him, Kosya, how did the Buddha briefly explain freedom through the ending of craving? Please share this talk with me so that I can also get to hear it. So, my dear Moggallana, I approached the Buddha, I asked him about that question, and the Buddha said to me, Lord of Gods, it's when a mendicant is heard, nothing is worth insisting on. When a mendicant is heard, nothing is worth insisting on, they directly know all things. Directly knowing all things, they completely understand all things. Having completely understood all things, when they experience any kind of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, they meditate observing impermanence, dispassion, cessation, and letting go in those feelings. Meditating in this way, they don't grasp at anything in the world. Not grasping, they're not anxious. Not being anxious, they personally become extinguished. They understand rebirth is ended, the spiritual journey has been completed, what had to be done has been done, there is no return to any state of existence. That's how I briefly define a mendicant who's freed through the ending of craving. And Saka finishes off, that's how the Buddha briefly explained freedom through the ending of craving to me. So Moggallana approved and agreed with what Saka said. As easily as a strong person would extend or contract their arm, he vanished from the gods of the 33 and reappeared at the Eastern Monastery. Soon after Moggallana left, Saka's maid said to him, I'm just going to interject here that it's not exactly clear like what the narrative voice is at this point, like who was actually watching this conversation. Moggallana wasn't there. There weren't any other monks around. But anyway, I'll pass that over. Soon after Moggallana left, Saka's maid said to him, good sir, was that the Blessed One, your teacher? No, it was not. That was my spiritual companion, Venerable Maha Moggallana. So he refers to him as spiritual companion, Sahadamika, because he's a stream enterer at the time. And the maids replied, you're fortunate, good sir, so very fortunate to have a spiritual companion of such power and might. We can't believe that's not the Blessed One, your teacher. Then Maha Moggallana went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side and said to him, sir, do you recall briefly explaining freedom through the ending of craving to a certain well-known and illustrious spirit? I do, Moggallana. And the Buddha retold all that's happened. And then the Buddha was happy with what the Buddha said. So this is the shorter discourse on the ending of craving. So as I mentioned before, Saka appears many, many times in the suttas. And so there's a whole samyutta with a collection of texts on that. We can see that he is like, presumably, I don't presume to guess, but probably like many people, I'm going to say, on the one hand has this spiritual aspiration, and on the other hand he likes his nice things, which makes it kind of hard. And so when the Buddha was teaching about this letting go, it's a challenging teaching. This is, I think, one of the lessons of this, you know, that it's not about, you know, it's obviously this sutra is taught with a bit of humor in it and a bit of lightheartedness, but there's a kind of very serious message that there is this tension in this life. And we need to sort of keep reminding ourselves. And even if we think that we're established on the path, then you keep reminding ourselves. And notice that Moggallana isn't like, you know, he's not saying to him, you know, you can't listen to the orchestra or, you know, whatever. It's not that, but he's just saying, well, bear the Dhamma in mind. And so this is the shorter discourse on the ending of craving. So I offer that for your reflection this evening. And I'd like to invite if there are any questions that anybody has about that.
I think that you thought this on that last evening, because did a Brahmin giving a handful of kosya to sit on, like somewhere?
When the Buddha became enlightened, you mean?
Yeah, before the enlightenment.
Oh, probably, yeah, it's kusa grass, yeah.
He studied, I think, I can recall something a month ago.
Kusa grass. Yeah. I mean, obviously, kusa was a common kind of grass, right?
Yeah.
So it's used for a lot of things, but it is found a lot in that kind of. It was used. They would spread it on the altar, like the Brahma, when they're doing the Vedic rituals. They spread it on the altar, and I can't remember exactly how it goes, but anyway, it was very prominently used. Yeah. So Dan mentions that when he hears the phrase "nothing is worth insisting on," he thinks of deep listening, the week of silence and inner listening and silence that speaks. He'd like to acknowledge the silence and grief of the First Nations this week. So yeah, thank you for that, Dan. So a question from Samarth: how's MN37 related to Digha Nikaya 21? So Digha Nikaya 21, the Sakkapanha Sutra, is the first time the Buddha meets Sakka. And you can see that it's a much more elaborate text with many different questions and so on. So MN37 must be later. And it seems to me that Sakka was ruminating on the questions that were left at the end of that, end of DN 21, and then came back at some subsequent date to ask the Buddha about it. So, probably because it's connected, you know, directly to the end, you know, you assume it's probably not that much after, and probably, you know, maybe the second of the discourses involving Sakka and the Buddha in the canon. So Sumana mentions that in Japanese, kusa also means grass. Oh, interesting. Justin asks, if nothing is worth insisting on, is that also not true of the Buddha's teachings? Is that true?
Yes.
Yes? Heresy. No, not at all, not at all, not at all. Well, tell us more.
Because once you understand the teachings, you don't need the teachings anymore?
Once you understand the teachings, you don't need them anymore, right? So the Buddha's teachings serve a practical purpose to help us become freed. And the Buddha used the simile of the raft. He said, once you've crossed over the river, leave it behind. It's right, the notion of ehipasika, right? To see it for yourself. Yeah. So, this of course is really important, and the suttas do comment about this, you know, and the suttas are meant as a practical guide that's there to support us, inspire us, teach us, and lead us towards freedom, but not in themselves something to get attached to or to create problems over.
It's really interesting how the characters in the suttas, you know, when you listen to the stories, a lot of these are very similar to what goes on in our daily lives and our personality.
Right,
and,
right, yeah.
Pretty much the same as what we're experiencing.
Right. I mean, you can see it's really interesting to me. That's why I love it, because it's so, in one sense, it's so alien and so foreign, right? Completely different kind. 2,500 years ago, and all of these gods and palaces and everything.
Yes, that's
right? But their minds, how they think. I mean, and that kind of evasive talk by Sakka is just like, you know, it's very kind of psychologically observant. You can imagine, like, you know, I mean, you see that, like, you know, even when people are doing interviews and things like that. I mean, it's a classic interview technique, right, that they teach you, is you don't answer the question. Who would do that? You know, you just say what you came there to say. And so Sakka sort of, and you know, you can imagine that if you're in a position of power like that, especially, you know, Sakka's obviously the patriarch, you know, he's the guy in charge, and people usually just do what you say, you know, and most of the time they just go, yes. And if he starts talking about his glory days in the past when he beat the Titans, they'd be, oh, yes, it was a glorious battle, you know. And but Mogalona is distinctly unimpressed by that kind of thing, yeah.
What words did you have
In the Pali Sutta, yeah. It's mentioned, but it uses a verb form from it. So it's not exactly the nouns hiri otapa, but it's a present participle, so it's like being hirid and otapad. Is that right? Being full of hiri and otapa. Yeah.
Remorseful.
Not remorseful. Having prudence and discretion in that case. Yeah, remorse is a different word. Yeah, remorse is
question that yes. Would be related, but related to sutta reading. So can you say a few words about the different gestures as mentioned in the sutta? So like in the beginning, it's like, oh, somebody bow and sit onto one side, somebody stand on one
right.
side.
Right.
So you have different gestures. Like,
right.
That's kind of interesting information.
It is,
telling
yeah.
Telling who that person is.
Yeah.
And of course, also the ending also. Sometimes you get the circle three times and
that's right, yeah.
Sometimes they just
right.
arrangements.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
A story for people who
know
how to read it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So the question was an interesting question about like when people come to see the Buddha, then they will, or not just Buddha, but other people as well, but they will display different things. Some people will bow, some people sit to one side, some people stand to one side, some people will circumambulate. So I think circumambulation is a sort of special sort of extra sign of respect, you know. So bowing and making anjali. So it probably goes like anjali and then bowing and then circumambulation. It's like kind of gradations of respect. Yeah. And you know, sometimes it's not exactly clear. Like when it says "I'll sit to one side," I mean it probably means that you know you're not like when you come to see someone, you don't like sit right in front of them. It's a bit kind of confronting. You know, so you sort of sit off to one side. It's a bit more humble and a bit more, you know, rather than sort of directly confronting them. So yeah, I mean, look, I'm not going to go into all of those, but I think it's, you know, good to sort of pay attention to that. And they are definitely there as a clue to the attitude of the people who are coming to see the Buddha and like where they're coming from. Yeah. So a couple of other. Questions in the chat. Eddie asks, Bhante, here we go, if not sutta related questions. Eddie asks, if I can ask a non-sutta related question, how did I let go of the desire for fame and my guitar as I was in a band long ago? Did that happen gradually? Well, look, it's not that unrelated because like the previous sutta, DN21, actually does feature Panchasika the Gandharva, well-known guitar hero of the time. You know, I mean, those Gandharvas, they could shred. So... I won't talk about that too much, but for me it was a gradual kind of thing where I came to Buddhism because I was looking for something new, actually. So it was kind of the other way around. Like I was already on that journey after music and looking for something else. I'd already felt like I'd done the things that I wanted to do. I'd been on Countdown, which is like, the, you know, what can you say? And if you grew up in that year, in the 70s and 80s in Australia, you would know what that means. But that was like the dominating cultural force for every teenager at that time. We did a lot of fun things, and you know, we had the highs and the lows. You know, we played with like the Eurythmics and INXS, and we had like, you know, beer bottles thrown at us on stage, and you know, the whole kind of spectrum of human experiences is in there, and. Yeah, ultimately, I felt that I needed something new. I needed a new direction, so I came to Buddhism kind of out of that. It was a bit of a kind of, bit of a wrench to sort of let go of my beautiful 1972 Sunburst Telecaster with original pickups and the Vox AC30 with the Blue Celestians from 1966 and all of these kinds of things. It's not that I have a sort of particularly clear memory of these things after all this time, but anyway, moving on. But like sometimes, you know, sometimes there is more of that wrench, but there's also sometimes there's more of a feeling like, you know, this is where you're going. Like this is, you know, if it had been a few years earlier, I just wouldn't have been interested. But it had to be that time. Yeah. All right. So probably time to wrap up. Thanks, everybody. Oh, I believe we've got an announcement.
Yeah.
Come.
Yeah, thank you, Mark.
Come.
Yeah, thanks. So Cynthia from the Metta Center, she just asked me to say a few things about an upcoming meditation retreat. So it's called the 9-day Natural Samadhi Retreat, Boundless Love Meditation to Nirvana. So this is based on the TWIM techniques, Tranquil Wisdom Insight Meditation. And it's being taught by two monks that are coming from Sri Lanka to teach this retreat. So Bhante Ananda and Bhante Metananda. Besides, you know, the 9 days, people can also join for 4 days. So the Saturday and Sunday at the beginning on the 4th of November, and the weekend, and the next weekend, the 11th and 12th of November. So for the 4 days, it's only $150. That's the cost of it. And it's happening in the Blue Mountains. So if anyone is interested, please check the events page on the Metta Center website. And I also have some of these leaflets just on the table outside. If you have any questions, let us know. Yeah, so this is, the leaflet. Yeah, just outside. Thank you.
Okay, very good. And, sorry, yeah.
Sorry, on that note, it's not about this retreat, but about this Jata's retreat.
So I'm having a retreat in December. Go on.
Is it fully booked?
I'm yet to put it on. Bloody hell.
But you know, it is open. We have about 25 registered already, but we can take more.
Because someone tried to register and it was the link had expired, apparently.
No, they must have been, they must be using last year's time URL.
Have any problems with registering, then just get them to email Deepika and she'll sort it out. I'm teaching a retreat over Christmas here in Sydney, so that's a 10-day retreat, so please come along. It's the same venue we used last year, which was really nice. We're also, just to let you know, the end of the Rains retreat is coming up soon, so we're having a Katina, which is on the 5th of November. So the details for that will be, they're practically already on the website if you don't look at it too quickly. Are you doing a Katina event as well?
Our committee will be hosting Katina.
Okay. And what's the detail, time and date for that? Don't know. Okay, so where should they look? People look to find that.
The committee will organise it.
Committee will organise it. So Isavira will be doing an event. So check out the website. Wait for further update for the committee, but it'll be on the website.
It's
whatever the committee organises. Okay. So we're having a Katina on the 5th of November. Isavira will be having one at some point. And then we're doing a book launch with Venerable Brahmali and some various events. So Brahmali's coming over to Sydney and we're going to celebrate the publishing of his Vinaya translation, which has finally been completed after many, 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 many years of work. And what date for that? 9th of December will be the book launch at the State Library of New South Wales. So coming events, a Katina on the 5th of November, then the State Library book launch with Brahmali. Brahmali will be doing other events around that time, and the retreat over Christmas New Year period.
And Metta Centre is organising something with a Deborah funding as well.
Right.
At that time, there'll be like a gathering.
We'll post all the details for the various events with Venerable Brahmali. So that'll be really nice. And it's so wonderful for me and so inspiring. I've worked with Venerable Brahmali from the beginning with his translation, and it's really amazing to see his commitment and perseverance to bring it through. Yes. Yes, lots of Katinas. Yes. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Oh, Santi Katina also on the 19th of November. Thank you very much. Okay. Cheers. See you next week.